Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to I'm Absolutely Fine, the podcast from The Midult that looks at all the glamour and indignity of being a grown-up.
Hello everyone, I'm Annabelle and I'm absolutely fine, but I bumped into a friend of mine on this freezing morning today and I said, how are you? And she said, well, you know, I'm so tired that I've got to go for a root canal this afternoon and I'm seeing it very much as downtime. Actively looking forward to it. And I had a very hard relate to that. It's like at least for 2 hours, no one can ask her to do anything. They will, but you know, she's going to be able to either not reply or just say, I'm having a root canal. Please leave me the fuck alone.
Has she ever had a root canal? Jesus.
What, does she know what she's in for?
Yeah.
I think it just feels like respite, however bad it is.
No, well, I mean, there is a lying down element.
There's a lot of lying down.
Let's face it, that's fine.
How are you, Em?
Well, I'm absolutely fine, but I've actually got groin strain, groin pain.
That's elegant.
It's like, hi, how are you? I feel like I need to say this to people now. I'd quite like the word groin.
It's quite an effective conversation stopper, isn't it? Exactly. Where do you go from there?
Nowhere, hopefully. Just stop speaking to me. Me and my groin strain.
Is it making you limp?
I have noticed, if I'm not like concentrating, I am limping. It's brilliant. The limping, groiny, grown-up woman in the park. If you see her, do not speak to her because she just wants to be left alone.
Yes.
Anyway, our next guest is a member of the DDC, the Dead Dad Club, like Annabelle and I. Sadly, Carrie Ad Lloyd has been a member since she was 15 when her father died suddenly. After years of floundering, she has taken her grief and turned it into a beautiful living thing by talking about it on her award-winning podcast, Griefcast, and writing about it in her wonderful book, You Are Not Alone. She talks to people about their experiences of grief and death, and in doing so has become a friend to hundreds of thousands, creating a gentle grief guide on how to navigate this most personal and painful of experiences. We are delighted to have her on the podcast. Carriad, how are you?
I love that you're laughing. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much. I'm absolutely fine. But this morning, my eldest child asked me to make her a clay air dry unicorn lamp, which was as a gift, and it was so complicated that I swear to God, you would need to be like a trained sculpture artist to do this. I tried to start with the easiest thing, a butterfly. We made it. I burst out laughing because it looked like one of those before after memes. Like it just looked nothing like the picture. And I was really laughing like, this is so funny, right? And I looked at her and she just said, I didn't think this day could get worse. And so I have had to promise, dropped her off at school and I had to say, would you like me to try and make one while you're at school that's better? And she said, yes. So now I've got so much to do. At some point today, I have to try and make a miniature, tiny, air dry clay butterfly to go with the unicorns and the flowers that we're making. I mean, and obviously I'm going to do it.
But talking of things you do well, thank you so much for your book, You Are Not Alone.
Thank you. It very much
made us think about our own experiences of grief. My father died sort of slowly, but then suddenly, the way that happens in 2001. And yours when, Emily? 2011 or something,
yes,
was it?
Yes, 2011.
And,
2012.
And we thought about how few resources there were and how little we felt able to talk about it, and therefore how little we did talk about it, and therefore how we ended up in a bit of trouble later on. And so, you know, you talk in your book quite interestingly about speaking the language of death, don't you? And how that can be integrated into our living lives. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that can be helpful?
Yeah, I just think we just don't talk about it. That's it really. And I sort of say in the book as well, like, because we all grow up with parents not talking about it, you don't learn it. The example I often said on the podcast, Griefcast, was that I don't know if you remember the first time you were a small child and like someone brought a baby around and then you'd hear, oh, it's so lovely. And I remember thinking, oh, we all have to say nice things about the baby. Okay, right. That's, oh, right. And then, you know, I remember my mum saying, or people just coming up to my mum after my dad had died when I was 15 and sort of saying, I heard chin up. And she'd go, wow. Thanks. And then they'd walk off and I would go, was that about my dad? Was that about death? I don't know. So I think we don't grow up talking about it. We don't hear people talking about it, or we hear very sort of snippety things. So we're just not practiced. And that's the big thing I wanted to do first with the podcast and then with the book, is just to say to people, you shouldn't naturally be good at this. I mean, we've just been talking about the things we're not naturally good at. Of course, if I practiced air dry clay every day, I'm sure I would get there. And it's the same with talking about death. When I started the podcast in 2016, I had years of my own grief, but there were lots of things that I hadn't talked about. I hadn't talked about child loss with anyone. I hadn't talked about baby loss with anyone because I hadn't experienced it. And then through doing the podcast and realizing, just having these conversations, practicing them, sitting and being uncomfortable, saying to people, I'm really sorry, I don't know what to say at the moment and I'm struggling and I'm like, give me a second and I'll help trying to find my way through this conversation. I sort of realized like, oh, anyone can do this. It's not like I've got special skill because my dad died early. It's just like I've just had a bit more years of practice and a general interest in talking about this. But I'm sure, as all your listeners and you yourself know, everyone will experience a death at some point, and everyone has also had people in their lives who've been grieving and hasn't quite known what to say. Like, we've all been in both camps, most of us. And so it's okay to not know what to say. And it's also okay to feel like, God, everyone's so shit. Why is no one saying the right thing? Yeah. We just need to start from there of like, God, this is really hard to talk about. How do we do it? Let's start using the word dead more when we are talking about it. So with kids, I'm a huge, not fan. I can't think of the word. I'm too tired. Proponent of that, of like saying to children, you know, granddad is dead. Like, and just,
rather than granddad is in heaven.
He's in heaven, or he's gone away, he's sleeping, he's watching over you.
He's on a
farm,
he's being very well looked after.
Just yesterday, like, my youngest one just said something, I don't have a grandpa. And I was like, no, you don't have a grandpa, like, ready for this. And my eldest was like across the room. She went, no, they're both dead. I was like, yeah, that's how I brought her up. But I want them to be able to say it. Like, it's not a terrifying thing that somebody's died, because when you make it terrifying, when you don't even say the word, you also make people afraid of their own death. You know, like, yes. This is, oh my God, what will happen? And it's like, well, it's all going to happen. So the sooner you can get them to start using the correct phrasing. And I, you know, I'm not saying sit down and be like, look, they've got stage 4 cancer and it's spread to this Mr. Ty. Like, you know, you don't have to go into details, but using the words, and I think that helps your own grief as well. When you start just saying, yeah, my dad is dead. The grandpa is dead. He died a long time ago and it's sad. That's okay.
It also helps, I think, doesn't it, to distill the panic that we feel about it. And I think what can happen, and I've certainly been guilty of this, is if someone has a huge and meaningful and terrible loss, I have disappeared because I have thought that my presence might be an irritant, that I would say the wrong thing, that I would be inappropriate, that I would do the opposite of helping. And so I think if you could talk to us a bit, because you're so helpful in your book, about what to say, you know, understanding our limitations in terms of helping and offering some solace, but also knowing what we perhaps can offer, what it's okay to say.
I always start with saying, it's really hard. Everybody has a case in their life and they're like, oh, I didn't do great there, did I? like even me, queen of the talking about death, has had people have gone, oh, why didn't I just ask them about it? Like, I panicked. So the first thing I always say is, it's hard. You haven't had any practice, that's okay. And the other thing I think is really important is people act like you get one shot at a death conversation, which I find really strange. They act like, I blew my chance. I saw them in the high street and I crossed the road. I blew my chance, that's it.
Oh my God,
and you're like,
you're so right.
You can go
back. I've missed the boat, it's all over.
Grief lives with you forever. So the great thing about it, supporting someone, is you can come back to them and say, I was really shit last week. I'm so sorry. I saw you and I just absolutely panicked. And I just had to think about it and I've realized that's so unhelpful. So I just want to say I am here and I don't know if that's helpful or it's not helpful, but I want you to know that I am desperate to help you and I'm here. You know, you can come back and rectify things. Like, I have had people do that to me because obviously I've been in the club such a long time, the Dead Dad Club, or the Grief Club, as we say on my show. And so I had people contact me, like, you know, I got Facebook messages saying, like, from school friends being like, oh, my dad just died. I'm in my mid-20s and I've suddenly realized how shit we were when you were at school. And I'm like, yeah, that's okay. Like, I get it. You, how could you have known? And so I think it's perfectly okay to go back to someone. And also, you know, obviously it's always context. Everyone's grief is very different and people want different things. And absolutely, you will encounter someone that that doesn't want your presence. But it's okay to check. It's okay to say, would you rather be left alone? You know, there's so many ways to communicate with people now. Like, you can send a WhatsApp, you can email, you can send a DM. So I'm a big believer in saying, just thinking of you in a text or a WhatsApp. That's very calm and neutral. They don't have to reply. The big thing as well, like, don't ask them. Don't say, what can I do? Because it's too much. So saying to someone, how are you today? Is a really great one, because it narrows the perimeters down to like a very like, well, actually today I'm all right. Or today's not a bad day. Or today is really awful. And also just turning up and being present with someone. So I always say to people, like, it depends how close you are to the friend. You know, we've all got friends that, like, you sort of stop and say hello, but you don't really know them. Obviously, if you turned up at their house, they might be a bit weirded out why you've turned up. But making sure you do stop and say, I heard about your mum, dad, brother, sister. I just want to say I'm so sorry. What an awful thing to have happened. That's terrible. And I think people feel like they need to add something to that sentence. So we all feel like we want to fix it. We want to say, and I'm sure you'll be okay. Or they had a good inning. All of this stuff that we say, you have to get good at silence when you talk about grief and death. So you have to be okay with saying to someone, I heard your dad died. I'm so sorry. That's awful.
Everyone panics.
Everyone goes, oh God, I must say, let them hear you say that and let them just go, they are hearing how shit I'm feeling. And then, you know what, if you wait, they'll probably just go, thanks. And then you'll probably just change the subject. Like, that's the thing, is we all think, oh my God, what will happen? I promise you, no one wants to have like a massive grief conversation most of the time, but it's nice to be acknowledged that someone you deeply loved is dead.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that sometimes, we were just talking earlier because Emily's got to write a condolence letter.
Yeah.
And we can get really hung up on the idea that we have to say something meaningful, that we have to, as you say, attempt to fix it, that we have to somehow serve up a precious memory of this person who has gone. And that's hard.
Yeah. And I haven't seen this person for about 15 years, but his father's died and we all hung out a lot in childhood. So I knew his father. So I know that I know him
well.
But it's that awful kind of like, hi, I'm only writing to you because your father has died. But also I want to say, you know what, I remember him. And I think I remember when people wrote to me about my father, and it was just a thing that was just like, I remember your father being in the world, and that was a good thing. And that's a nice thing, I think. When I, you know, find the letters, it always moves me, the people who bothered to write, you know.
I've never, and you know, I've done nearly 200 episodes of the Griefcast, and I never met anyone who was like, oh, I didn't like that condolence letter. Like, everybody was always like, you know, sometimes you're overwhelmed by them, or you didn't reply, or, you know, but mostly people were like, oh, it was lovely to know that. Because what you're doing when you write a condolence letter is you're reminding someone that there are a million versions of us. You know, there's the father-son relationship, there's the father-friend of the son, you know. And when you remind someone, oh, I knew them like this, you add a little piece of that person back for them. And they are sitting with their grief as a child, has lost their parent. And they're like, oh, yes, they were a father figure to that person. They were a friend to that person. They were this. And you sort of start rebuilding that person in a memory. And you don't have to, like you said, serve up the most, you know, elegant, eloquent, witty, oh, they did this for me, and actually, by the way, they gave me the key to a golden treasure. Like, it doesn't have to be epic. It just has to be, I really remember them being such a lovely person, and I was always happy to see them, and you must be missing them, and you know, I send you all my love. Like,
quick, I'm writing this down. Yeah.
It's funny, because hearing you say that makes me feel really emotional, because I realize that saying that is meaningful.
Yeah,
really meaningful. Yeah. It doesn't have to be lyricism, does it? Or an anecdote that's like pre-packaged and delivered.
This is the thing, we panic because we don't like talking about it, and it makes us feel uncomfortable. We think we're doing something wrong, whereas actually the problem is grief and death are uncomfortable, because it's sad to realize that we are, in you know, creatures with a timeline. And so that's what you're fighting against. But I think we go, oh, I've this is horrible, so I need to find something that's going to make this feel better. But if you get, this is the only mental switch I've done in all the work I've done on grief, is the mental switch I now go, oh, that feeling that's uncomfortable, just sit with it. It's okay. You're not doing anything wrong. And the best thing, I interviewed Rob Delaney when his book came out, A Heart That Works, about the loss of his son, Henry. And he said something to me which really stuck with me, which he said, when you tell someone like terrible news, you know, or you know something terrible about someone, all you're really asking is for 4 seconds before they reply or try and fix you. And if you give someone 4 seconds, if, you know, someone says, oh, my so-and-so just died or this happened, and instead of replying straight away or panicking, you sit with it for 4 seconds and think, that person's son's just died. 1, 2, 3, 4. Your reply will be, my God, that's awful. It won't be, oh, well, I'm so sorry to hear that. You know, like, you just need to sit with people's pain for about 4 seconds and then trust it's not your pain. It's not your life. That's happening to someone else. They just need you to sit with them for 4 seconds so they're not alone holding this horrific grief. And I think we just find 4 seconds really difficult. But when you break it down to just allow yourself to think and take in what someone said, and I, you know, God, you can apply that to all tragic news of any circumstances. Just let it sit with you for a little bit before you feel the need to go, well, you know, they had a good innings, they're in a better place, it's good they weren't in pain for too long. You know, all of these things we say, which are chin about up. Us. Yeah, chin up. That's about us trying to make us feel better. And what you have to understand is the person can't feel better. Someone has died. So you don't need to try and make them feel better. Take that job off the table, because someone's dead. You can't bring them back. That's the only thing they would really make them feel better. So take it off the table and just let them be sad, and then trust that you are not going to be damaged by that sadness. You're okay. Because, you know, we're humans. We feel like sadness is contagious. That's totally normal. It's okay. It doesn't make you a bad person. And let it be there, and then just say to someone, God, that's fucking awful. I'm so sorry. And then you can find your way up through after that. But it is about breathing and trusting and not panicking. All of those things are hard to do.
This is an advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online.
Okay, serious question. How many times have you been out recently? Actually, you know, scratch that. How many times have you woken up the day you were supposed to go out and felt flooded with dread? How long have you spent praying that the other person will cancel so you don't have to?
And yet, just as we're avoiding people, so many of us feel really lonely and more tired than ever, particularly now the days are getting a bit longer and you think, how am I going to have the energy to go out into the world?
Our social batteries are very flat at the moment, and that can make us feel isolated, which can lead to trouble. And in my experience, therapy has helped me track my best energy sources and helped me better identify what leaves me feeling depleted.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try?
It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist and switch anytime for no additional charge.
With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise.
Listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/midult. That's betterhelp.com/midult.
BetterHelp, because sometimes the best thing to do is acknowledge that we are not, in fact, absolutely fine.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I noticed a lot in your book, you know, talking about the grief process and how, you know, how it was sort of reflected with my grief process, or rather my lack of process. One, in the fact that I had to make other people feel like I was okay, which is so, you know, people pleasing things. So I'd be like, oh, no, it's fine. You know, he had long illness, whatever, you know, all that sort of stuff, like I'm okay. And of course, not being okay. But also I had my daughter was only 11 months old when my dad died. And I think that's in your book, isn't it? About the layer of when you've got something, like not a distraction, but another kind of caring
A responsibility,
process,
a huge responsibility.
Delay.
Yeah.
And it bit me in the ass 5 years later.
Yeah.
And I started kind of hearing voices. And I think a lot of that was like unprocessed grief. And I went through that whole sort of thing with a therapist, which was incredibly helpful. But that's the thing. The grief process is not linear. There are no rules, right? So, you know, as much as one would like to believe that we can fix things with words or we can fix it, you know, there is no structure. And you're very good on the frustrations you had with the official grief roadmap, which is the Kubler-Ross
Yes, the
guide.
Sort of grief myth that there's supposed to be this, we all know the stages of grief, but we're to understand, I think from your book, that they weren't designed for the grieving person. They were designed for a dying person. Is that right?
Yeah, I get so angry about the five stages because it's such a strange thing that we all know it. Like, how do we all know it? Like, it's like, it's viral. Like, it's insane that you ask anyone who about death or grief, even if they've never lost anyone, and you say, oh, do you know about the five stages? Most people are like, oh yeah, like after someone dies, you go through these five stages. It's a lie. It's bullshit. It's not true. As I say in the book, quite aggressively. So yeah, Kubler-Ross is this amazing, amazing woman. She, you know, founder of the hospice movement, changed the way we talk about death and grief, was working with AIDS patients in the 80s. She's incredible. However, in 1969, she writes this book on death and dying, which is based on her work of working with terminally ill patients. So not even, you know, how most people die, you know, some people die of cancer, not everyone does, but that's what she was working with, people with cancer. And at that time in America, they wouldn't use the word cancer. They would use the word malignancy for everything. And they wouldn't tell people they were dying. So you, especially if you're a woman, you wouldn't be told. They'd tell your husband, or they wouldn't tell children. And they would be giving you drugs that you thought were making you better. And then you would die not knowing what the fuck was going on. So, hey, 1969, there was a lot of stuff as we remember, you know, we know wasn't cool. So she came along and said, I think you should tell people they're dying. Here's my idea. She noted when you told someone they were dying, they went through these five distinct stages of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And then she noted that also if you told them, they would reach this place of acceptance and they would have, inverted commas, a good death, because they would be able to sort out their affairs, tell people they love them, all the things that we now take for granted. But it was always, always, her whole theory was people who are dying. Like, so, and that makes sense, right? Dying has an end. Like, yes. If you know you're dying, you're reaching that full stop. Here's my last day. I need to do all these things. But grief doesn't have the full stop. Like, it just continues. You just live with it all the time. And you have to carry on being a mother or working or being a friend or, you know, being a wife, girlfriend, whatever. Like, you have to continue being yourself and holding this horrific pain. And so the five stages, I mean, I've looked into it. I cannot see when it went from dead people to living people, when people went, oh, let's make this about grief. Because it was never designed to be about grief, ever, ever, ever. And if you read any modern grief psychotherapy, they all hate it. Everybody now says it's really unhelpful. It's harmful is the language I read. It's harmful to the person who's grieving to put these stages on it. There's no proof of it. It makes people think they're doing it wrong. It makes people think it's linear. It makes people search for this magic day, you know, like January the 31st, once I'm going to hit acceptance and I'm going to feel fine. And we all know that's not what happens. It's not how you grieve. It comes, it goes. You can delay it, as you said, if you have caring responsibilities. Or you can delay it just because your brain cannot cope with what has happened to you. And my dad died, it's like 26 years now. I still have days where it like slaps me around the face. And I think, oh my God, it was his birthday over Christmas. And my mum said to me, oh, he would have been 70. And it just was like, oh, that's more real than, oh, he would have been 68. I don't know. It hit me and I had a real moment. I thought, oh my God, he would have been 70. He didn't get that moment. I just had a sad day. I let it pass and I was fine. But if I was someone who believed in five stages, I would then spend months thinking, there's something wrong with you. Why did you feel sad? You're so weird. Why are you still talking about him? And so we need to treat ourselves with such empathy and kindness and accept, like, if someone was important to you, and I use that phrase carefully, it doesn't mean that you love them or you had a good relationship with them. If somehow they were significant to you, because you can have hated someone and still have lots of grief for them, then that will stay with you for a long time. And just ignore anybody who tells you, oh, you must be going through your five stages, or you're, you know, just throw it out the window. No one else is using it in modern day grief psychotherapy. So it's so unhelpful. Grief is this lifelong mess. And all that happens is you get used to carrying it and you get better at carrying it. Much in the same way as parenting, you know? Like, it starts the first time you become a parent, you do not know what you're doing. And then years later you think, God, I've got better at this, haven't I? I do kind of get like what they need or what I'm supposed to be doing or remember to bring snacks. Like, you know, it takes time, and it takes time to learn to live without someone in the same way that it takes time to learn to live with someone.
And I think as well, you know, exactly like you said, you know, with parenting and all the different stages, you know, in life, like you said, you know, your father would have been 70, but I had a piece of news the other day and I before my brain sort of like caught it, I thought, oh God, Dad would find that really funny. And he's been dead 12 years, yeah. You know, and it's like, then you get that secondary shock and you think, oh God. And it's not like you don't collapse on the ground weeping and wailing and rending your garments or anything, but you do feel like you're carrying, you're sort of in proximity to that sadness that you carry, that because someone is gone.
Yeah, I think it scares us, because if you remember early grief, it's so overwhelming and we can be so upset. So any kind of sense that it might come back is like, oh God, am I going to be in bed for 6 days true. Because I'm remembering
something?
Oh my
God, I think you're absolutely right. Anything to keep that at bay.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And actually, of course, as with all mental health things, if you welcome it in and let it in for a bit, it doesn't stay very long, because it doesn't need to, because you've acknowledged it. It's the batting it away, the denying, I'm fine, which I'm absolutely queen people pleaser. Like, you know, it's fine. I'm sure we're fine. Don't worry about it. It's okay. Like, and that is
I feel like I have to make it even better by people by telling them grisly details. Like, no, he was absolutely terrible at this, and this. Don't worry. Like, it's sort of like, it's so mad. It's like, sort of, like, as if somehow, yeah, the whole thing, I can't be worthy of it somehow. Anyway.
Well, it's self-soothing, isn't it? It's because it's very painful and it's very upsetting. And so anything you can do that makes you feel slightly more in control of it, because you weren't in control of it, and slightly less panicked about how awful it is. Like, it's just so normal for a human brain to be like, I don't like it, this is horrible, yuck, what can I do? And like, you know, if you eat something disgusting, you throw it away and you don't eat it again. With grief, you're like, well, I know this is horrible, why is it still here? Like, why am I still having to eat this disgusting pudding? So I think, like, forgive yourself for those feet. Like, it's again, like, you know, the brain is a bit mad, and so sometimes you have to say, okay brain, I see that you're panicking, but we don't need to panic. That feeling is not going to destroy me. I'm not going to be, you know, like, wiped out and, like you said, snotting in Sainsbury's suddenly. And also, if I am, that's okay. It's okay. You're allowed. Somebody has died. You're allowed to feel sad about it. But we just are so desperate to get away from the feeling. And that's why the five stages persists. Because wouldn't it be great if it was true? Wouldn't that be amazing? Oh, I just have to go through these horrible feelings, but they'll go. Great. Okay, cool. People who are like type A, like, you tell me what to do, I'll follow the instructions. We're like front of the queue. I know how to do grief. Great, brilliant. I'll do it all. Yeah, I'm very good. I'll listen. And then you do it all and you're like, oh shit, I still feel awful. What the hell? Like, that's not part of the deal. So it's accepting that life is not all brilliant. You will feel sad. You will have these overwhelming moments where you remember news or, you know, my dad was like obsessed with technology. So every time something new and it's like, you know, something happens where you're like, wow, God, you know, now the iPhone does this. I think, God, he would have lost his mind over that. Like, he would have been talking about that for weeks. And so they call it re-griefing. Like, you're just having this re-grief where it like kind of comes up again. But again, it's trusting, like, it's not going to destroy you. It's not going to overwhelm you. Just let it be. You get, like you said, you have that day where you feel sad and then it will pass. It always does.
There's something terrifying about the idea that we could be grieving forever. Mm. But woven through that is the idea that what we're in fact doing is entering into a different but ongoing relationship with the person that we've lost, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That the relationship maybe continues.
Yeah. It's just different.
And I remember saying to somebody after my father died, you know, does this get better? And they went, it gets different.
Yeah. Mm. And it's really hard to hear. I get that. Like, if you're starting the journey, and so, and when I speak to people sometimes and I say it's 26 years, I see their face of like, oh my God, am I going to have to talk about this? She's still talking about it. Shit. And I'm like, no, like, you know, not everybody feels like this. Not everybody makes it their life work. Like, it's, you know, it's, this is a very particular example, but yes, that feeling that it's going to be like this forever is really panicky. But that's the thing I'm always trying to say to people, like, it isn't, it changes. And the example that they use a lot is like, you have this mess of grief and it's like a big squiggly, horrible mess that fills up your whole life when it happens. And then you obviously your life continues. And so there's more space around the grief mess. But that doesn't mean the grief mess disappears or goes away. There's just a lot of life around it that buffers it. And that's what people mean when they say time heals. Time doesn't heal. Time allows you to have more experiences and memories that make it easier to deal with sadness, which is not a quippy thing to say. But I think it is really important to accept, like, everything has changed. Your life is completely different. And you will be grieving a life where you didn't know this pain. Like, that's also in there. Like, you're sad the person doesn't exist, and you're sad you know this crap. I don't want to know this. I don't know that people die and this is how it feels. Like, I want to go back to the days where I was like, oh, I think I'll be fine when my parents die, or, you know, like all of this stuff people tell them.
You often hear, don't you, people saying, when I wake up in the morning, just for a second, I think everything's okay.
Yeah, it's so common because, again, your brain wants to protect you. And I remember that vividly when I was a teenager, waking up and being like, oh, what's going on? What am I doing? Oh, my dad died. That's what's happening. Oh, that's what I'm dealing with. And then being like, oh, that blissful moment where you just don't know about it. But again, like, it's okay to have that moment. It's okay to remember, like, these things are really, really hard. But the fighting them is what makes it harder. The fighting that of like, I do not want this feeling. I do not want to feel sadness. I want to be fine. I want to be okay.
I want to be like the other people.
Yeah, I want to be like everyone else, walking in the sunshine, having their hamburgers, and not talking about it. But also, we know that's not true. You know, we know that everyone has grief and pain in different ways. You just can't see it. So when you accept that everybody is in this club in some way or other, like everybody is. And so there's not like a magic sunshine land that you're banned from. It's just you now see the world in full color, which is there is this horrible gray bit of sadness and there is life and happiness. And now you have to color balance your life and see both of those things and hold both those truths. And that is hard. It is hard. But there is a beauty in it and there is a peace in it and there is a joy in it that you can appreciate things that then you really understand how much life matters and life means. And it's not to say you have to have this, like, you know, poignancy about your life. You can just be happy you've got a chocolate bar. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be big and meaningful all the time. But I think anyone who's been through a big grief does feel that way, that like it changed their life somehow, in some ways for the better, in some ways not, but in some ways for better.
That's been an extraordinary thing I've seen in the few people I know who've suffered, you know, horrific losses that aren't just sort of like, you know, sort of, you know, died peacefully at 88.
The natural order of things, yes,
yeah. And I've noticed almost without exception the way that it's been very hard to bear watching their pain and being in proximity to this horrific, unnatural, you know, appalling thing. And then I've seen them dimensionalize and rise and become magnificent. And this is the beauty that you're talking about. It's not something that we would ever wish for, but it is in there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely in there. And I think that's what people find hard as well, of like, grief is, when we say grief, we act like it's one emotion. And that's also why I hate the five stages, because it distills it to five emotions. But it's a mess. It's anger and sadness and joy and beauty. And like you said, this resilience and this brilliance and this magnificence and this horrific patheticness. It's all of those things thrown in your face at once. And you don't wish it. I'm not glad he died when I was 15, but it certainly has become a part of me that is a strength and that has allowed me to open up a world that I definitely wouldn't have been able to had he not died when I was 15. Like, that's just a fact. And that's the thing about facts. It's not good or bad. It's just the truth. And yeah, I think the other thing, just to quickly say, in case anyone's listening, we always say on the show that there's no hierarchy when it comes to grief. Everyone has experienced all things, but child loss is the top. It is the worst. And it is against the natural order of things. And so when you are dealing with that situation, it's not something where there are any simple answers or any kind of, oh, well, there's joy in that. Like, no, I'm not saying all griefs, because there are, of course, some griefs that are just horrific. And I would really recommend, there's a writer, Jason Green, whose daughter died in horrific circumstances, who did a book, I'm looking for it, that, Once More We Saw Stars, and Rob Delaney's book as well, which really deal with the hugeness of that grief. And like you said, the unbelievable quality of that tragedy that someone has to find their way out of and also don't always manage to. So, and that is also, you know, you don't have to rise from it as a glorious phoenix, but there are other griefs more in the natural order of things where I call it in the book the fire. And I think most people have experienced that. Like, you do have this weird, like, you're so vulnerable after grief, but you're also so strong because the worst thing has happened. And that's how I was as a very strange teenager, because it was like, what could possibly be worse? Like, oh, this boy doesn't like me. Oh, everyone in my school thinks I'm weird. Like, who cares? Like, I was sort of untouchable for about 5 years. And then you become sort of, I think, a bit more human, because you're like, oh, actually, I do care. I started caring again. But for a while, I didn't care. And that's quite unusual for to be a teenager who doesn't care what people think. And I think we've all experienced that when we have had a loss.
It's funny. I think in grieving, you can perhaps at the beginning lose some of your humanity.
Yes, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Because it's like all your resources are being sucked down to deal with this kernel of pain. And then you regain it in different ways later.
Yeah, and you are changed forever. And that is very hard to accept. It is. Yeah. And it might make you, you know, more bitter or more angry or more sensitive. And those things can be really hard to rectify with the person before, who seems lighter and happier and like they were carefree. But as we know, they still had, if you went back to that person, they'd be like, oh no, I'm stressed about this, I'm worried about this. Like, you only know once you're through the door of the club and you're like, oh, I see, that's what really mattered. It was that.
I also think a lot of what also resonated with me and your grief is all the questions that you still have for the person who died, because obviously, you know, with you it was extremely quick and happened. My father's death was extremely slow, but it's still ended in a death, and there are still unanswered questions, you know, that, and it's so difficult, that, isn't it? Because you're basically like, why? But at the same time, what would you have thought of this or whatever? Yeah. You can't ask those questions, and it's incredible. It is like you said, yeah, it's something you just carry and it does change you.
You carry it. And I mean, it took me a long time to go to therapy, which is quite common for teenage grievers. Just shout out to any teenage grievers listening. If you haven't been yet, don't worry. So I didn't go till I was in my 30s. And something my therapist said, which really stuck with me, is she was, you know, when I had all these questions, she said, do you think you know what he would have said? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, well, then
yeah, that's
you
that's
kind
true.
Of have the voice still. And that was like, I mean, I cried a lot that session, because I was like, oh, because I think it's very easy to feel like you don't have anything. They've gone, I've got nothing. And then you kind of, you know, you do have the memories and you do. I mean, this is what, it's a very intense thing to say, but I'm a very intense person. Like, when it comes to parenting, my belief is like, you just have to love a child so strongly that they still feel it when you're dead. And my dad, for all his faults, he was absolutely insane, but I definitely still feel his love and felt loved after he died. And that has made my grief easier than other people I've interviewed who could not conjure that as well. And I think that's, like you said, if you have that voice in their head or something happens or questions or news, like you said earlier, you said, oh, I know my dad would have found that funny. And like, just knowing that is something that we have of the person who's gone, of like, you know what their reaction would have been, you know what they would have said to you, you know how they would have looked at you. And even though that stuff is, it's really bittersweet, because you know it, but you don't have it. And some people don't know it and don't have it. So it's about sort of grasping the things that you can sometimes.
I think sometimes one of the cruelties of grief is that it can murder memories.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, our great friend Gavandra Hodge wrote her remarkable book, The Consequences of Love, about reconnecting with memories of her sister who died age 10, because she just didn't have them.
Yeah.
They'd been swept away in the violence of what had happened. So sometimes, whether it's therapy, it can be about getting to know the dead person again from a very different place.
And that's why, like, we come back to the condolence letters or people who knew them, you know, and like, there aren't a lot of photos of my father as a child, but the ones I have seen, like being able to be like, oh, that was him as a kid. Like things that obviously as a teenager, I never had those conversations, because why would you ask your dad about what they did as a child? Who cares? And so, yeah, Gavandra came on Griefcast as well. And I, you know, obviously what happened to her was so horrific, but the way she now remembers Candy, that they make this incredible birthday cake covered in sweets, because her sister who died very young really, really loved sweets, and they make it on her birthday every year. And it's like, it looks like a Pick a Mix has vomited onto a cake. And
it tastes like a Pick a Mix.
And I love that so much, because it's such a beautiful, true way to remember that, to remember Candy. And I think that's what we have to look for, is the rituals, is the ceremonies that are true to the person that you've lost. And, you know, that can be really difficult if you had a bad relationship with that person, or it ended very suddenly, or they were very young, all of that stuff. But if you can find a way to something that you think, God, they would have bloody loved that. It's somehow soothing. It doesn't bring them back. It doesn't take away your grief. That's the thing that, again, I keep saying, like, you're not looking for rituals or therapies that are going to take away the grief. You're looking for things that are going to enable you to hold the grief. And that's, yes, a big switch to get your head around sometimes, of like, I don't want this feeling to go away, but how can I feel like I can take it?
Yeah. I mean, you are proof, I think, that maybe we don't need to protect ourselves from other people's pain as much as we think we do. Yeah. Because you spend a large proportion of your life talking about other people's grief. Yeah. And yet you are not rocking in a corner, howling, unable to cope with the cruelty of the human condition. You, yeah, know, you're, it has, I suppose, enriched you in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I when I talk to palliative care nurses, it was quite strange, because I sort of realized that I have the same attitude as them. And I was like, that's quite unusual for a comedian to immediately get on with people who work in palliative care. Because I'm like, yeah, right, everyone dies. And I definitely have a slightly negative view, in that if anyone's ill, I will think they're going to die. And that's my death anxiety. But all I see is resilience. Like, all having interviewed 200 people about their losses, as much as there's so much earth-shattering sadness, there is an equal amount of earth-shattering strength, beauty, joy, happiness, resilience. And it's taken me such a long time and so much therapy to accept that the human brain wants one thing to be true all the time, and it's wrong. You have to keep telling your brain two things can be true at the same time. And I can miss them, and it can be the most painful experience of my life. And it can be something that changed my life, that, you know, enabled me to write a book, that has opened up other doors for me, that has connected me with all these people. So, you know, and I think when you accept that two truths exist about grief, what you start to accept is that that's how people work. We're not all good. We're not all bad. We're everything. And my father is, you know, was a really difficult character, but also had amazing things about him, and, you know, was a significant person in my life, despite him being really quite difficult to be around most of the time.
I mean,
yeah. Yeah, right? And yeah, so, you know, you stop looking for things to be so binary and be like, everyone's good and everyone's bad and grief is awful, and before grief I was happy. And that's just like, that's not life, is it? That's not what you, when you look out in the world, that's not what anything looks like. But it isn't easy to get there, and it's definitely taken me a long time, and I've gone back to therapy several times. So I think, yeah, being kind to yourself in this process of, like, some days are easier than others, some days you don't think about it at all and it's great, and you know, and then it just hits you in the face, and just being prepared for, like, however you feel is all right is the only way I manage it these days.
And also, I've noticed with some people, you know, admiring their bravery in acknowledging that sometimes they're okay.
Yes.
You know, and I found that an extraordinary thing to behold when someone suffered a terrible loss and they go, a friend of mine once said to me, and something, the most horrific thing, as we discussed, had happened to her, and she said, I am proof that we can survive anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the Jason Green
book. With a smile on her face. Yeah.
The Jason Green book, when I interviewed him, it similar was like, you know, he said, what happened? What did he use? It was something like, what happened to me was almost, was like metaphysical. Like, it was beyond tragedy. And that here I am. And it's a lot to get your head around. And it's a lot, as you said, I'm a big believer in kindness to those around the grieving. Because I think sometimes either you're the epicenter of a grief, or you're watching, as you said, someone bear a lot of pain. And it's also, like, it's hard to watch people bear pain. Like, you are also allowed to need therapy, to need to talk to someone, to struggle when you're seeing your loved ones hold horrific pain. Because I think we also be like, oh, well, it hasn't happened to me, therefore I don't need any help. And actually, you know, when my husband lost he's lost both his parents, and he was very close to his mum. And when he went through that, it was horrific. And I write about that in the book. Like, I was terrible. I was so bad. Yeah. I was like, come on, chop. It's going to be okay.
Chin up.
Like, we can get through this. You've had 6 months. Come on, probably time to. Because I found it so difficult to watch him be so sad. And then the big turning point was when I was like, oh, I don't have to fix him. I just have to wait for him to feel a bit better. And that's, you know, and there's another great episode, Kaylee Llewellyn, who's a brilliant, brilliant comedy writer. She had 6 significant losses in 1 year. And I mean, significant, really, yeah, horrendous. And she, I quote it in the book, because her friend Matt came round and she said, she was just sitting on a sofa staring at a wall. She couldn't do anything else. And Matt just sat next to her. And she said, you know what, just to have someone sit next to you while you are unable to speak, talk, move because of the grief you're dealing with. She was like, it was huge. It was life-changing. It was momentous. It was the greatest thing anyone had done for me. And that, again, we come back to what we're saying. Like, we feel like what we must do must be Hollywood-style epic. It was actually just sitting on a sofa next to someone, saying nothing, but reminding them, you will not be alone with this feeling. I'm not going to let that happen. I'm not going to cross the road. I'm not going to change the subject. I'm just going to be here. Presence. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes because perhaps of our own self-esteem, we feel like it's not enough for us just to be there, but actually it really is.
Mm. Yeah, that's a big lesson, I think.
Yeah.
Listeners, if you are struggling with grief, you know someone who is, or you're just curious about humanity, then we would strongly recommend/order you to read You Are Not Alone by Carrie Adloyd, and tune in to her podcast, Griefcast, because just listen to the woman.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. I have to say, there were so many bits in the book where I was like, yes, I had to stop reading, think about it. It's just wonderful. And I think exactly like Annabelle said, you know, and as you say in the book, it isn't just for people who've lost someone, but it's so helpful for people who are in the proximity, which we all are, people who are going through stuff.
Well, thank you so much. And the paperback is out on the 1st of February. So now you can carry a light copy and protect your wrists.
Who wants a heavy handbag?
Who wants a heavy handbag? We've already got bottled water in there, and the tissues and the wipes and the everything else. Yeah.
Don't forget the tweezers.
Oh, gosh, don't. I did recently and it was not good. It was not good.
Good luck with your rainbow butterfly.
Oh, my God. I'd forgotten. Thank you.
Off you go.
When you said rainbow butterfly, I was like, the air dry. Look, I'll send you a picture.
Thank you.
I think 3 attempts and I'll get there. I think that's what it's going to take. And it's quite small. I'll do it while I'm having lunch.
You know, Carrie Ad, it's going to be absolutely fine.
It's going to be fine. Thank you so much. It was really, really nice to talk to you.
Wonderful to meet you. Thank you so much. And lots of love. Okay.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Annabelle Rifkin and Emily McMeekin of The Mid-Alt. Our book, I'm Absolutely Fine, is out now. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and subscribe.